My beloved brethren and sisters and our dear young people, well, we're certainly living in remarkable days. We've seen so much, brethren and sisters. We've been blessed to see so much. And it's in this dangerous and evil world, we've had a lot of encouragement. And of course, tonight, President Reagan has been swept into power in the United States of America. And in his speech in which he accepted the second term of presidency, he said that the best years of America are still ahead of them. And they, of course, are very high hopes, and we know, of course, that that's not true. But you know, brothers and sisters, such is the importance of the days in which we live, that in the second debate which he had with the other candidate, the Democratic candidate, to Walter Mondale, the fellow was reviewing that the other night on the ABC in the light of election prospects in America, and he made the comment how that in the second debate, one of the most damaging questions that were asked the president by Walter Mondale was, what's all this talk about Armageddon? Because President Reagan had been going around using that term in lobbying for the religious vote in America. And that's the question he got on the American television program. What's all this talk about Armageddon? And the commentator said, my blood ran chill, he said when he replied. Well, Armageddon is a Bible term, he said, and it will be fulfilled. And he believed that it would be fulfilled in a nuclear war between the great powers. The best years for America are ahead of us, he said. What a contradiction in terms that is. And evidently, brethren and sisters, the President of the United States of America is aware of Bible prophecy. He quoted Ezekiel 38 on another occasion, aligning that with Russia. Incredible. All of this, I believe, in preparation for the day when the Lord Jesus Christ will return. Those people won't be converted. They won't believe that, brethren and sisters. He doesn't believe it himself. On the one hand, he says that Armageddon will be fulfilled, the nations will go to nuclear war, and on the other hand, he says the best years of America are ahead of us. Contradiction in terms. They don't believe what they say. But the fact of the matter is that there is alive in America a bit of knowledge of that fact. And that will all contribute to that great and glorious day of which Habakkuk the prophet is speaking when he said, the mighty one shall come from the south. And there will be an awareness, brethren and sisters, an awareness in the Western world much quicker than the rest of the world, who that mighty one is when some of the facts are revealed towards them. Because Armageddon will, by that time, have been, of course, history, and their world will be settling down after that great and terrible Holocaust. Habakkuk is a remarkable prophecy, brethren and sisters. They all have their little unique features, and Habakkuk has a unique feature of his own. The two unique features about Habakkuk's prophecy is that he's the only one, you know, that calls himself a prophet. They're all prophets, but he introduces himself in verse 1, the burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. And in chapter 3, we read in verse 1, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet. And so here is one who gave himself the title of the prophet. And he certainly was a prophet. Now let's try and identify his prophecy tonight and see what we can learn about it. And as I say, the other unique feature about it is this, that two-thirds of this prophecy is a conversation, a recorded conversation between him and his God. So we have a remarkable prophecy, brethren and sisters, one who styles himself the prophet and whose words basically are the report of a conversation between him and his God. And the revelation of the divine will, which Habakkuk himself, brethren and sisters, had to learn about and accept and to bow to and to have faith in. What a wonderful prophecy. Now on our chart, we've got Habakkuk placed about here, as you will see, which nears the end, of course, of the kingdom of Judah under Zedekiah. Now why do we put him there? Well, in chapter 1, we can read from verses 5 and 6, but Yahweh refers here to a power that was rising among the nations. Behold ye among the heathen, and regard and wonder marvellously, for I will work a work in your days which ye will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I will raise up the Chaldeans. Now, brethren and sisters, it was about this time, the time of Habakkuk, that the Babylonian Empire began to make itself felt in the world. So he must have prophesied around about the time of the rise of the Chaldean or Babylonian Empire. Now back in verses 3 and 4 of chapter 1, he makes reference there. He says, O Yahweh, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear, and cry unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save?
Why dost thou show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are they that raise up strife and contention. So he was prophesying at a time of iniquity in Judah. He was prophesying at a time of iniquity in Judah and at a time of the rise of the Chaldean power. So it was obviously, brothers and sisters, before the fall of Jerusalem and during the course of the rise of the power of Chaldea. Now you'll remember our study in Nahum that we spoke about the fall of the great power of Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire. And of course all the nations clapped their hands. But here's a prophet who is prophesying around about the time of the fall of Nineveh, almost within the very years of the fall of Nineveh, who's prophesying of another threat from the north. So all those words of Nahum, of joy and gladness and relief for the kingdoms of Israel and Judah, were far from being fulfilled, brethren and sisters, in their day, because here's a prophet at the time of the fall of Nineveh is talking about the rising power of Chaldea. And so his prophecy would have been around the years 600 to 610 BC. Around about those years. I believe on consideration we perhaps should have him on our chart, and this chart of course is under constant review. I think we should have him a little bit further over here in the days of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Certainly I think it was after the days of Josiah, because he's complaining about all the law being slack and judgment never goes forth. That wasn't the case in the days of Josiah. As though the people may have been hypocritical, it couldn't be said that the law was slacked and judgment never went forth, because it did go forth in the days of Josiah. So obviously Habakkuk prophesied up here in the days, around about the days of the years of Jehoiakim. And there were about 20 to 30 years then, brothers and sisters, to the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonian power, which at this time was called the Chaldees, which was the early name of the Babylonian Empire before it became known as Babylonia, and was rising now to great prominence in the north of Israel. He would have been a contemporary, I suppose, with Jeremiah. He would have known about Jeremiah. As a matter of fact, either Habakkuk or Jeremiah quotes each other, and I'll show you that because it's an interesting feature about the prophets. They quote each other. So he was a contemporary, brothers and sisters, with Jeremiah, getting near the end of the collapse of the kingdom of Judah. Now of the prophet himself we have no details at all, except that he's called the prophet. Now one wonders why he's called the prophet. And you know why I believe he's called the prophet, brethren and sisters, and this only can be an opinion, of course, I can't prove it, because I believe that he would not normally have expected to be a prophet. Because though we've got no details of him, the last verse of his prophecy, I believe, is eloquent as to what he was. Because here we read, in the last verse of his prophecy, the last words of that verse, he says, to the chief singer on my stringed instruments. And it would appear from that expression, brethren and sisters, that he was a Levite. And not only a Levite, but a Levite that had been dedicated to the temple service. And you would not have expected him to be a prophet. And though that expression doesn't prove that he was a Levite, that is an expression used in the Psalms, brethren and sisters, and we know that those Psalms were set in order by David and by Samuel and by Hezekiah for use in the temple services, and we know that there were Levites with stringed instruments who were appointed from the three houses of the tribe of Judah, of Levi, that they might minister in the temple. And one would not expect such a one to be a prophet, but he says, I'm a prophet. And we read in the book of Chronicles concerning those Levites that they did prophesy with harps and with stringed instruments and with their trumpets. The music was prophecy. It wasn't, brethren and sisters, meaningless words, meaningless melodies. They were melodies with words which were full of meaning. They were prophesying with those things, as we should prophesy every time we get up and sing a hymn. Prophesy, not in the sense of foretelling the future, but sending forth from our mouths, the words of truth as they set in those hymns. And so that's why I believe he calls himself the prophet, because you wouldn't expect a man like that to be a prophet. But he was a prophet, a singing prophet. And the last chapter of his book is a psalm. Matter of fact, it's set in prose. It's beautiful in its poetic structure. We won't have time to look at it all tonight, but there's so many parallels and so many plays upon words in that last chapter, brothers and sisters, that it's a study on its own, that chapter, as it draws upon the greatness of Israel's past and the wonder of Israel's future. Now, Habakkuk's name means the embracer. And we will see that name, brothers and sisters, and the meaning of it set in the context of a New Testament word of prophecy later on as we move towards some of the words of Habakkuk. The embracer, one who embraced heartily the things of Yahweh. You know, it could well have been, by the expressions used here by the prophet, that he was a Levite, and that he was not only a Levite, brethren and sisters, who during the course of certain times of the year were dedicated in each month to the temple service, but the law of Moses said, and this is a law which not many people know that it's there, but it's certainly there, the law of Moses said that if a Levite who had been ordered by the law to serve in the temple services during the course of the year, that if he found it in his heart that he loved that duty with all his heart and soul, he could choose of his own volition to stay there forever. He could embrace that position if he wanted to. And I believe that Habakkuk could well and truly have been one of those who never departed from that temple, day nor night, but who, embracing the things of God, were seen with their stringed instruments singing the glory of Israel's future and telling them the words of the prophet. That's how Habakkuk would appear to me as we look at him in this book. And being a Levite, brethren and sisters, he stood for the things that were right. And we find that he complained about all the evils that were going on around about him. Now what we'll do now is have a look at the divisions of the prophecy. See how the thing is divided up. And basically the prophecy falls into three divisions, chapters 1, 2 and 3. And here in chapter 1, brethren and sisters, we have the prophet's frustration with continuing evil. He got really frustrated about it. And so in verses 1 to 4, he complains to Yahweh, who seems to be indifferent to evil. Now Habakkuk never believed that Yahweh was indifferent to evil, but it seemed that way. And in his frustration, he complains to Yahweh that Yahweh doesn't seem to be moving in the matter. You know, brethren and sisters, we do things like that. Not because we question Yahweh's morality in the sense that he's indifferent to evil, but we say one to another, I can't understand how God in his patience can wait any longer. It's not an evil to do that, brethren and sisters. And being humans, of course, we don't understand the divine. And to us there seems to be an endless frustration with this evil. How can he stand by, we think to ourselves, and allow this to happen? And yet we know in our hearts he's got a plan, and we accept that. And Yahweh, in verses 5 to 11, reveals his intention to punish Judah by using the rising power of the Chaldeans, which came to Habakkuk, brethren and sisters, as a terrible shock. He never believed that Yahweh would do that. And so he comes back to God in the conversation, which is recorded in chapter 1, and he complains of a seeming injustice in using a heathen nation to punish Israel. He can't understand that. He cannot understand that. And so that's how the first chapter is divided up. Having made his complaint the second time, in chapter 2 he receives Yahweh's reply. Yahweh replies to Habakkuk. In verses 1 to 4, he points out to Habakkuk, there's none more righteous than another. Because Habakkuk's complaint was that how could God punish righteous Israel with the unrighteous heathen? God's answer was, there's no man more righteous than another. No man. Faith alone is the basis of justification. He's got to correct that view in the prophet's mind. And then from verses 5 to 20, Yahweh reveals that he's in complete control of the situation. The Chaldean will be destroyed when he's finished with him, and Israel will be saved to the ultimate vindication of Yahweh's word. But a misconception, first of all, about humankind's relationship to God. But let's correct that misconception. And when that misconception is corrected, Habakkuk, I want you to know that I'm in complete control. The Chaldean will never get out of my control. Though that might appear, brothers and sisters, for a time to be the case. And you know, when we watch the Russian, if we were here long enough to see Russia make its grand move for the building up of its image empire, I don't suppose there'd be a brother or a sister who wouldn't have a moment in his life where he'd think to himself, can Yahweh stop them? My word, he can. And that was the reply that God gave to Habakkuk. Habakkuk, having received his reply, chapter 3, brothers and sisters, is not just simply a psalm. It's a psalm of the Habakkuk's personal faith in God. The prophet rose to greatness in that third chapter, personal greatness, in setting forth before God his acceptance of the divine will. He pleads in verses 1 and 2 for mercy upon Israel, because he could see that God was right and that he had every right to bring the Chaldeans upon them for their iniquity. There was no man more righteous than another. And then from verses 3 to 15, he gives a graphic acknowledgement of Yahweh's ability and power to carry out his plan. He just doesn't get on his knees and say to God, you've got the ability to carry out your plan. His faith was so great, brethren and sisters, that he graphically portrayed it in his mind and portrayed it in his words that God had an ability to carry out his plan. And then verses 16 to 19, some of the most beautiful words of the prophecy, is Habakkuk's faithful acceptance of Yahweh's will. He accepts the fact that there is present distress before ultimate glory. Present distress must come before ultimate glory. And this ecclesia, brethren and sisters, has been given graphic lessons of that. And we've had to realize, for all our prayers, for all the prayers for health and vitality and vigor, they have been answered, brethren and sisters, according to God's will. And God's will is this, that there will be present distress before ultimate glory, and we accept it. And the brethren and sisters who are left accept it. And we do so in faith, because that prophet had to accept it, brethren and sisters. That's our answer. And there'll be no other until Christ comes. Believe me, there will be no other than that until Christ comes. Wait for it, he was told. Wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Wait for it, brethren and sisters. That's the answer of Habakkuk. The question of waiting. Frustration, yes, but it will come. It will not tarry. And so there is the prophecy in a nutshell. If we were to summarize it, we'd say, well, Habakkuk complains to God and says, I see all this evil going on. Aren't you doing anything about it? Yes, says God. This is what I'm going to do about it. Oh, but you mustn't do that. Yes, I will. And this is the reason. God, I accept that. And in faithful acceptance, he spelt that out in a beautiful song. And that is, brethren and sisters, in a nutshell, the prophecy of Habakkuk. Now we'll put that back on again, because as we deal with each division, perhaps it'd be good to watch it. We'll just have a look at each of these divisions as we go on. And in chapter 1, verses 1 to 4, we come to that section, and I'm only going to comment very briefly, brethren and sisters, upon each section. In chapter 1, verses 1 to 4, his complaint of Yahweh's seeming indifference. And he cries out unto Yahweh, how long shall I cry, he says in verse 2, and thou wilt not hear, and even cry unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. And he saw and said to God that in verse 3 that he was a beholder of strife and contention. And you know, brethren and sisters, we are entering into an arena of strife and contention. I do not want to be, to the Enfield Ecclesia, a prophet of doom. But brethren and sisters, we would be doing less than our duty if we weren't constantly reminding you that we're entering into a period of distress, strife and contention. You've heard me say that before. Many of you think in your mind, what's he getting at? It won't be many moons, brethren and sisters, before you'll all know. Because there is trouble, big trouble, everywhere in the ecclesial world. We intend to bring you all together in about 4 weeks' time, God willing, where there will be an open forum in this ecclesia, and we will tell you everything. And you'll have your opportunity, brethren and sisters, to ask your questions and to make your own comments. And we intend to tell you all, on behalf of the arranging brethren, where exactly we want to go in the will of God. We're not going to make any vows, because we've got no power to perform them. But we're going to express to you, brethren and sisters, by God's grace, where this ecclesia is going to go. And I'm going to tell you, brethren and sisters, if we have not got a united ecclesia, We will never make it. And we have no intentions of taking you into a dangerous era without you knowing where you're going. And I tell you what we intend to do, brethren and sisters, or should I say, I tell you what intend what we intend not to do. We are not going to change for anyone. And if you want to come with us, we'd love to have you. But brethren and sisters, I say this kindly. I say it as kindly as I can. If you don't like that, we would be better without you. Because we can only help the brotherhood if we're together. And we're going to need every heart and soul in this meeting in the near future. Because there's trouble. And Habakkuk knew that, brothers and sisters. There was violence, there was spoiling, there was strife and contention. And you know what it was all about? He saw three things which he felt were absolutely, he couldn't do anything about. He felt beyond his power in verse 3 or verse 4. There were three things, he said, he couldn't reverse. First of all, the law was slack. There was a numbness about the law. Nobody could implement it. Or nobody would implement it. That was the first thing. The second thing was that judgment never went forth. If the word of God was not expounded, brethren and sisters, if it wasn't understood, then the principles could never be implemented, is what he's saying. And the third thing was that the wicked outnumbered the righteous. You know, brethren and sisters, we have lived many years with a majority, I would say perhaps almost a total majority of this ecclesia at one. I hope that continues. Sad to say, I don't think that everyone's going to continue with us. And we're going to find a time, brethren and sisters, where we may cry to God before the coming of Christ that no longer we have a lot of friends. We might not. We might, but we might not. But change we will not. Because we want in this place the law of God understood, spoken and understood, and above everything else, brethren and sisters, we want it implemented. And we want the righteous to outnumber the wicked. There's a lot of talk, brethren and sisters, courageous talk from platforms about putting the law of God into operation. There's a lot of that talk. People stand, like I'm doing now, and saying to you, this is what we're going to do. But there are few with the stomach to do it down there. And that's what's going to be called for. We're going to have the stomach, brethren and sisters, the courage to do it there, on the floor, not up here. And all this talk that goes on, and people patting people on the back and saying, look, he speaks from it. That's not good enough. That is where it's wanted to be done, brethren and sisters. The law is slack. The principles are not implemented. That's the problem. They've got to be implemented. And when they're implemented, the righteous will outnumber the wicked. Talk's no longer, brethren and sisters. It's action that's needed. Don't you dare ever miss the January edition, the December edition of Logos. Don't you miss it. When that comes out, brothers and sisters, be insured you get your copy. Because there'll be a clarion call there. A clarion call we've not heard for years in that book. For the things we've always stood for. And that's what we're going to implement with God's grace here at this place. And that's what Habakkuk was on his knees and crying his eyes out, because he saw the ancient principles going down the drain. That was his prophecy, was all about that. Now from verses 5 to 11, as we've got up there, Yahweh reveals his plan. And where was his plan, brethren and sisters? Where was Habakkuk directed to look? Habakkuk, brothers and sisters, was not directed to look at a theory. He wasn't given a theory. Behold ye among the nations. Ah, there it is. And his eyes were lifted up. And God says, Habakkuk, I know, I can see it all going on, and already there is going to be an implementation of my plan. It's in operation. Habakkuk, look at the nations. And up there in the north, he says, was the rising power of Chaldea. See, God did know about it, brethren and sisters. There was the signs of the times. And you know, they couldn't see the signs of the times. You know why? Not even Habakkuk could see that for a while. because he understood most things. One thing he was hidden from his eyes was that sign. You know why? Because there was a national pride in that nation which didn't let them think that God could ever do that. They never thought that God could ever do that. And he says, look to the nations, he says, and regard and wonder marvelously. And everyone who believed it, and no one did at that time except Habakkuk, he lifted up his eyes and he did wonder. His mouth fell open. He thought, oh no! And brethren and sisters, today, what's happening in the ecclesia? You know, Habakkuk wasn't talking about new prophecies. God wasn't revealing new prophecies under him. They'd all gone before. They were hundreds of years old, some of them. He was talking about old prophecies, and people were wondering about it. And they didn't see the signs of the times in the north. And Habakkuk's mouth fell open. Oh no! And today, brethren and sisters, ancient prophecies, 140 years old as far as the brotherhood is concerned, and all over the world, people are saying, oh no! There's ecclesias, you can go to ecclesias. They'll write you a letter and they'll say, dear Brother Merton, when you come here, don't speak on prophecy in our ecclesia because it's a contentious issue. So you're not allowed to tell them. Mind you, we disregard that, but that's what they tell in the letter. Don't talk about prophecy because it's a contentious issue. Behold among the nations, says God, there's your sign. You think I'm indifferent? Look at it. Brethren and sisters, is your eyes open? Is God indifferent? President Reagan is swept into power, is he? Right. Do you know the Politburo has been going through a series of meetings in Moscow? Chernenko is not the Gog, brethren and sisters. Be assured of that. He's not Gog. But there's a young man rising in the Politburo, brethren and sisters. The youngest man they've had for years. And he's the star that's coming out of the east. He's the one, brethren and sisters, they're looking to at this present moment of time. Behold ye among the heathen. And wonder marvelously. Let us never wonder. For I will work a work in your days. You won't believe it, says God. I'll tell you, but you won't believe it. And so the work that God was going to work, brethren and sisters, was a work in their days. Now, what was that work? If you come to, keep your hand in Habakkuk and come to Acts 13, the apostle quotes Habakkuk, or rather, should I say, uses the prophet. He doesn't exactly quote Habakkuk to make an exact quotation of him, brethren and sisters, but to use the principle of Habakkuk. And speaking in the synagogue at Antioch in Pisidia, where Jews, he said in verse 39, who wouldn't believe that by him, that is by Jesus Christ, all that believe, all that have faith, are justified from all things which he could not be justified by the law of Moses. And there was a synagogue full of people who had a misconception, brethren and sisters, similar to what Habakkuk had. And they didn't believe that the just should live by faith, but by their personal righteousness. And there was a warning to that generation. And Paul in verse 40 brings forth Habakkuk. Beware, therefore, lest that come upon you which is spoken of in the prophets. Behold ye despisers, and wonder and perish. For I work a work in your days, a work which ye shall in no wise believe, though a man declare it unto you. They are not exactly the words of Habakkuk, brethren and sisters, but they are a use of the principle of Habakkuk. You see, God said to Habakkuk, behold ye among the nations. But Paul said he turned that into the ecclesia. He spun it around and put it into the ecclesia, behold ye despisers. And he turned it in on the Jews. Why? Because there was all around them a sign of the times, and their national pride wouldn't let them see it. And the sign was that the Romans, of all people, the Romans, whom the Jew considered the lowest form of humanity, the counterpart of a Chaldean, was going to sack the city of Jerusalem. No Jew could ever believe that. Because they believed that they were more righteous than the Romans. And they didn't believe that the just are so because they've got faith, whether they are Roman or Jew. Never could they believe that, though someone would tell them. And they were told by the Lord Jesus Christ, when ye see Jerusalem encompassed with armies, get out. Brethren and sisters, every Jew, other than those few disciples who follow our Lord, believed that when you see Jerusalem encompassed with armies, fight for your life. That was the national tradition, the first principle, the greatest fundamental of Jewish nationalism. And they'd never believe that that Roman could take that city. But he did. I will work a work in your days. And here he comes down from the north in Habakkuk's days, brethren and sisters. I will work a work. You know, that work is spoken of in Isaiah 28. Look what God says about it, brethren and sisters. Look what he said about it. In Isaiah 28 and verse 21, speaking of the selfsame thing, for Yahweh shall rise up as in Mount Perazim, he shall be wroth as in the valley of Gibeon, that he may do his work, his strange work, and bring to pass his act, his strange act. It was a work, brethren and sisters, which to them was strange. And you know, as the ecclesias, the voice of prophecy is stamped out of ecclesias because they can't agree as to what it means, and therefore you keep the peace by not talking about it, and the voice of the prophet is no longer heard, brethren and sisters. The work of God is no longer understood. And when you talk to people about the coming of Christ, and I'm talking of brethren and sisters, and you talk about Russia moving into the Middle East, and of Christ meeting him within a colossal confrontation, and you talk about blood flowing through this world up to their horses' bridles, brethren and sisters stand up and say, but he's the Prince of Peace. He wouldn't do that. And I have heard that said personally to myself. I will work a work. Oh, it's a strange work to many people, brethren and sisters, because they don't see the signs of the times. But it's coming. And that was Habakkuk's answer. He couldn't believe it, first of all. He had to be convinced of it. And God gave him, brethren and sisters, a graphic description of that strange work. He, back in that chapter 1 again, he gives him a description of the Chaldean. He says, look, Habakkuk, I know in verse 6, he's a bitter and swift nation. The Assyrian is gone. The people have clapped their hands in the world, but he's got a successor. Almost immediately he's got a successor. A bitter and a hasty nation. He'll march through the breadth of the land, Habakkuk. He won't miss any of it. And he'll possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. Oh yes, Israel's had a claim to the land. They've claimed the land by divine right, brethren and sisters. No one has a divine right in that sense. God's promises are promises. They're not rights. And yet Israel claimed that land by divine right. God said he'll possess the dwelling places that you think are yours. And he knows they're not his either, but he'll take them. And he told them in verse 8 that he's swifter than the leopards. He's fiercer than the wolves. And he'll spread himself like the horse coming upon them and fly upon them as the eagle. All those symbols, brethren and sisters, of unclean animals. Oh yes, the Chaldean was unclean. He was a leopard. He was a wolf, horse or an eagle. Bitter and hasty he was. But above all else, brethren and sisters, they may have seen him as a leopard, a wolf, a horse or an eagle, but Jeremiah saw him as Yahweh's servant, and they never could believe it. They didn't believe that God would ever conscript into his service a nation like that, but he did, just the same as he's conscripted Russia. Russia is conscripted into Yahweh's service. He doesn't know it, but he is. He is serving Yahweh, brethren and sisters. He's serving him unerringly in the prophecy that God is bringing upon him to come down upon Israel and to teach them once and for all the great lessons of life. Russia is in God's service doing that. Yet the Jew would never bar of him. But that's what was the problem here. And they couldn't see that. Verse 9 said, he will sup them up as the east wind. The east wind missed nobody. It rolled across from Gilead, brethren and sisters, from the east of Jerusalem. And as it came rolling across the Arabian plateau, it then trundled its way across the escarpment of Gilead, and below it was the great Gore Valley, the Jordan Valley, 1,290 odd feet below them. And as the heat waves shimmered up from the valley, it added to all the heat of the desert, and it blasted the whole of Judea and Samaria. Nothing got missed by the east wind, and here he comes, rolling at them like that wind, gathering heat as he comes. Tremendous figures. And he comes to verse 9 or verse 10. He scoffs at every opposition, treats her with contempt. Nothing can stop him. And then, brethren and sisters, when he's finished in God's service, he will make his fatal mistake. And whenever God brings to an end the service of the nations that he calls into his service, always, at the end, justifiably, he brings them to nothing. They all make the same mistake. They overreach their commission. As Zechariah in his prophecy said, they overreach their commission. And this one makes a graphic mistake in verse 11. Then shall his mind change, he shall pass over and offend, imputing that this his power is the power of his God. And there, brethren and sisters, is his problem. You know, in the original Hebrew, it doesn't really say that he imputes his power unto his God. What the original Hebrew says, he looks at his own power as God. It's not as if the Chaldean will come to Israel and bow his knee to some God and say, you've helped me overcome the Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews. No, brethren and sisters, he worships his own power. And in that, he will be brought to his end. God will be justified in all his actions. In saving the righteous, God will be justified by their faith. And in bringing to an end to the wicked, he will be justified by him because they impute to themselves the power in their own, their God as being their own power. And when Soviet Russia, brethren and sisters, thinks that evil thought, changes his mind and passes over and stands on the mountains of Israel upon the ruins of the Jewish nation and says that I'm a God because of all the power I've got, that'll be his fatal mistake. And so Habakkuk was given a tremendous lesson, wasn't he? But you see, he can't accept that originally, brothers and sisters. His Jewish mind won't let him accept that. He couldn't conceive that God would do such a thing. And so he complains to God of the seeming injustice that's in that chapter there. And coming to that point, brothers and sisters, we read in verse 12, he says, art thou not from everlasting, O Yahweh, my Elohim, my Holy One? We shall not die, O Yahweh, thou hast ordained them for judgment. O mighty God, he says, O Rock of Israel, thou hast established them for correction. You know, it's interesting, brethren and sisters, to gather those words together. You can see what was in the prophet's mind. He recoils in horror at the thought that the Chaldean could punish Israel. Now, he doesn't say that straight away because that's secondary in his mind. But the first thing in which he recoils in his mind is that the Holy God could use the Chaldean. Look at the titles that he uses. Yahweh Elohim, the Holy One. And the word there, Mighty God, you'll notice in the margin it says Rock. There's the Rock of Ages. And he recalls in horror that one who we worship, brethren and sisters, as he who will be mighty ones in perfection and holiness. He who himself is called the Holy One. The Rock of Israel. How could he ever use a power like that? You know, he's quoting the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy. Have a look at it. Keep your hand in Habakkuk. He's drawing upon the Old Testament references to God's character. I'm only going to point to one of them now, brethren and sisters, the Rock. And you see what he's thinking when he goes back here. He's thinking about this character. How could this character ever be involved with the Chaldeans? Listen to it. Here's the Rock, brethren and sisters. In verse 3 of Deuteronomy 32, because I will publish the name of Yahweh, ascribe ye greatness unto our God. He is the Rock. His work is perfect. I will work a work in your days that you won't believe. Oh, but his work is perfect. All his ways are judgment. A God of truth without iniquity. Just and upright is he. And Habakkuk thinks to himself, he's going to work a work in our days. He's going to use the Chaldean. He's going to use the Russian power. Who? Yahweh Elohim, the Holy One, the Rock of Israel. Oh God, he says, you're of too pure eyes and to behold evil. You can't use powers like that. Can't he, brethren and sisters? Is there not evil in the city, said Amos the prophet, and Yahweh hasn't done it? Not evil in the sense of moral evil. But is there death, brothers and sisters? Is there pestilence? Is there things going on in the world today that are bringing men to their knees? Isn't Yahweh's hand in all that? Time and chance happeneth to all. True. But time and chance, brothers and sisters, was put in motion by the first sin. It's all because men and women have left him that he leaves them. And he uses one against the other. He turns sword of brother against brother. He will in Armageddon. He does all that. And still he is holy. Habakkuk, brothers and sisters, had a profound and awesome understanding of God's nature. So great. So wonderful. That it went all almost beyond the bounds of what the word had said itself. And keeping your hands in Deuteronomy 32, come back to Habakkuk, and then he comes to the second point. He says in verse 13, you can't do that. You're of too pure eyes and to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. And he's still got Deuteronomy 32 in his mind. Wherefore, he says, lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue, when the wicked devoureth the man more righteous than he. And he said that sincerely, brothers and sisters, in the days of Jehoiakim. He didn't believe, of course, that Israel were righteous. He wasn't a fool. But he did believe that despite all their sins, there was something special about Israel. You know, brothers and sisters, let's get our facts very clear about God's purpose with Israel. If we think there's something special about Israel, you know, there is and there isn't. If we're talking about the nation and the fact that they are an indestructible race, and that they will be there at the coming of Christ in fulfillment of the promises made to Abraham, they are a special nation. Yes, they are. But if we're talking about he who happens to be born of a Jewish mother and father, as an individual and as a personality, there's nothing special about him unless he believes in God any more than there is with the Chaldeans. And it was that mistake that Habakkuk was making. Not wittingly, brothers and sisters, and he wouldn't have seen it like I've just spelt it out. But because he'd grown up with that attitude that Israel could not be hurt because they just happened to be Jews, no such thing exists, brothers and sisters. Look at the 32nd chapter of Deuteronomy. And after the statement about the rock and all these wonderful characteristics which Habakkuk is really referring to, we read in verse 5 concerning Israel, they have corrupted themselves. Their spot, or the margin says, they are not his children, this is their blot. Their spot is not the spot of his children. They are a perverse and crooked generation. And he's talking about Israel, and he says, here's the father, there's the rock, there's his father-like characteristics, and that crowd over there who they called Israel, they're not his children because they're nothing like him. That's what he's saying. And Habakkuk, brothers and sisters, hadn't seen that point, just right that. He'd known it, of course, better than we do, but he hadn't put it in that context. And that's what God was going to teach him. And until that misconception was corrected, he could never have written the third chapter of Habakkuk. And that's how he approached God. You're too pure of eyes and to behold evil. And you hold your tongue when the wicked devour the man more righteous than he. And in the last verses of Habakkuk chapter 1, brethren and sisters, he tells God in those verses that the Chaldeans make sport of people. They make merchandise of them. They fish for them in verse 15. They catch them in a net. And then they bow down to the net and they laugh and they say, what a wonderful net we got. And they worship it as a god. And he says, and you'll let them go on and on, raking in out of the sea of nations all these fishes and then bowing down to the net and saying, ha ha, we've done it all in our own power. And Habakkuk says, I can't understand how the God that I know of, Yahweh Elohim, the Holy One, the Rock, could ever associate in his work that people. But the reply, brethren and sisters, behold ye among the nations, I will work a work in your days. You won't believe it, he said, even though you told it. And you know, brethren and sisters, there are people with misconceptions of Yahweh's character. As I told you, I've met brethren who believe that all the words of Scripture concerning the great battles and the judgments that have come upon the earth are all verbal battles, that God will slay them with the breath of the mouth of his Son. It's all, he'll do it with his mouth. He won't hurt anybody. That's a terrible misconception of our Heavenly Father's character, brethren and sisters. That's humanism. And humanism will melt before the heat of Yahweh's anger. And we've got to recognize that. Flesh is flesh. There's no doubt about it. And of course in chapter 2, as Habakkuk moved into that chapter, brothers and sisters, he knew he was going to get an answer to this problem. He knew he was wrong. He knew he was wrong somewhere, like all people know they're wrong when they question God's ways. And he waited for his answer. And in chapter 2, we read, I will stand upon my watchtower, he says, and set me upon the tower, and will watch to see what he will say unto me, and what I shall answer when I am reproved. When I am reproved. He was like Jonah, brethren and sisters, who told the men to throw him overboard because he felt that if they got rid of him, they'd get rid of the problem because God was going to send him to Nineveh. He couldn't understand either what God wanted to do with Nineveh. But there's one thing about Jonah and Habakkuk, brothers and sisters, that was highly commendable. That in their lack of understanding initially, they bow to the Almighty. You know, that's a wonderful attribute. Though there may have been a misconception and a lack of understanding of God's purpose at the moment, they bow to the Almighty, and that's a wonderful attribute. We may not understand everything in life, brothers and sisters. We won't even understand this crisis that's coming. We won't understand perhaps all the actions that are taken. But whatever we do, we bow to the Almighty. And we know that what he says is right, as it was in the days of Noah, and he meant it. And whatever comes upon us, pain and suffering and anguish, sorrow for friends, we bow to the Almighty as these two great prophets did. And he knew that trouble was coming. And he was told in verses 1 to 4, Yahweh wasn't slack in answering him, brethren and sisters. Yahweh said to me, write the vision. Make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it. Habakkuk, he said, the vision is yet for an appointed time. It's not going to happen right away, but at the end it'll speak. It won't lie, though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not tarry. So he's going to get an answer. Now, brethren and sisters, we miss the whole point of Habakkuk if we miss this point. In chapter 2, he gets two answers. Not one, two. There's two things going to be told him. No way can God reveal his plan to destroy that Chaldean until he gets his mind straight about righteous people. Now I want you to think deeply about this, brethren and sisters. I really do, because this is one of the most profound points of Scripture, and it isn't mine, it's the Apostle Paul's. I'm going to show you in a moment. And it's not going to be easy for you to grasp this, but you think deeply about it. This man's got to get an answer to his problem. He can't understand how God can cooperate, or rather can use that nation against Israel. He can't understand also how that God could allow an unrighteous nation to attack a righteous nation. Now, the second point has got to be corrected before the first point can be answered. It's no good God saying to Habakkuk, look Habakkuk, I'll deal with the Chaldean in due course, I'll destroy him. Because Habakkuk still got that misconception in his mind, and he could go away, brothers and sisters, and say, oh, of course God had to do that because we are more righteous. There's no way that God could do it like that. So the first thing that God says was, Habakkuk, I want to get you to write something. And I want you to write it so big that a man running can read it. I know a lot of people don't read it this way, brothers and sisters, but this is how Paul read it. I'll show you in a moment. Write that vision upon tables, he says, and make it plain, that he may run that readeth. Now that's not a table, brethren and sisters, is it? And I've drawn that deliberately as a placard. Because that's how Paul read it. And here's a running man, and he's running past that placard, and it's written in such tall letters that he can't miss the point. Now it's been said that interpretation means that anybody can understand the Bible. That's not the point at all. That's not very easy to understand. It's only understood by people who are prepared to grasp the principle of it. The just shall live by faith. And faith, brethren and sisters, is the quality which makes a person righteous, not his ability. It's that quality alone that makes a person righteous. And that person who's got faith doesn't necessarily have to be a Christadelphian, born Christadelphian, I mean, or a born Jew. But he can become a spiritual Jew, and he can become by baptism and by faith in Christ a Christadelphian. He doesn't have to be born that way, because it's not the point. The point isn't in his background, his hereditary descent. It isn't in his ability, brethren and sisters. It isn't in his cleverness. It isn't even in his ability to understand God's word. It's his ability to absorb what God has revealed and accept that in faith and to order his life because he believes in God Almighty. That's the question. And that message is so plain, brethren and sisters, that it can't be missed. Now, what Habakkuk was told was this. You write it so a running man can read it, Habakkuk, because it's not going to happen right away, but it'll come. One day, he said, I'll write those letters for you. And everybody who's got faith will see them. You look at Galatians chapter 3, brothers and sisters. And if Paul is not dealing with that matter, then I don't know much about Galatians. You have a look at this. And this is the issue that Habakkuk first had to see. Here are your letters. Chapter 3 of Galatians and verse 1. Oh, foolish Galatians! Why were they foolish, brothers and sisters? Because they had missed an evident lesson. They believed that a man was justified by the works of the law. Chapter 2 and verse 16. Look at it. Knowing that a man is not justified by the works of law. They came to believe that. They were foolish. Why were they foolish? Well, back to verse 1. O foolish Galatians, who hath bewitched you that ye should not obey the truth, before whose eyes Jesus Christ hath been evidently set forth, crucified among you. Brethren and sisters, the word in the Greek for evidently set forth is a word which means a placard. What was on that placard? He'd been evidently set forth, crucified among them. What was on that placard? He works his way down through it in verse 10. For as many as are under the works of the law are under the curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone that continueth not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them. But that no man is justified by the law in the sight of God, it is evident. Look at it. The just shall live by faith. Now, brethren and sisters, in order that you may grasp the point, all you've got to do is on that placard, let your minds look at that placard, the just shall live by faith, and in your minds, see across that placard, not words, but a body hanging on a stake. And then look at that body and ask yourself, who is it? It's Jesus of Nazareth. And have a look at him. What sort of man was he, brethren and sisters? I'll tell you what he was. Perfect. He never did one single thing wrong in his life, his whole life. He never thought one single thought wrong in his whole life. And he's up on that cross to tell us that obedience to law can't save a man. Brothers and sisters, they are the tallest letters possible to write. You cannot get anything taller than perfection. It is evident. And every brother and sister that looks up there, I don't matter how simple they are, grasping that point, brother and sister, when that hits home, you can read that even if you're running. And if you ran past the cross of Jesus Christ in the day of his agony and saw him there, and knew anything about him, you couldn't miss the point. But that man was not saved by law. It's evident. Habakkuk, the vision is for an appointed time. It'll come. And it won't tarry. It's a long time coming, brothers and sisters, but it came. The just shall live by faith. You cannot write taller letters than perfection. That's Paul's exposition, I believe, of Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. But it wasn't the only place that he used that phrase. Three times in the New Testament he quotes it. And every time he quoted it, brethren and sisters, he emphasized one or other of those words. And in Galatians chapter 3, he said, the just shall live by faith. And the whole context of that chapter is about justification. In Hebrews chapter 10, he talked about the just shall live by faith. And he's talking about Jews escaping the Holocaust of Jerusalem and living. And in Romans chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, he says, the just shall live by faith. And that's the whole context is about the word faith. So wherever he quoted it, he's laying emphasis upon those three things. The just will in the end live by his faith and no other way. Now, until Habakkuk learnt that, brethren and sisters, he can learn nothing. God can't tell him about what he's going to do with the Chaldean and take him out of the way while he's got a misconception about that, because he could be, go away and believe, well, we're going to live because we're Jews. And we could never believe the truth, brethren and sisters, that God will bring down Russia upon the mountains of Israel unless we all first of all learn in the waters of this bath, of this baptism here, that not one of us can get ourselves into the kingdom, and that every day of our life we need God, and that there's no way in the world that willpower and physical strength is ever going to save anyone. When we've learned that, God will say, now I'll tell you how I'll deal with the Russian. Because we're fit men and women to be told that. Because we don't believe anymore that God is going to deal with the Russian, because the Christadelphians are more righteous than Russian people. Because we're not in that sense. And when that message has got home, brethren and sisters, then we are fit to learn other matters also. Now I want to take you to one of those passages of Scripture and show you the context of Habakkuk. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 10. The just shall live by his faith. And in Hebrews, when he quoted that, as I said, the emphasis is on the word live. Because it was a question of life or death in the city of Jerusalem. Now Jews, brethren and sisters, were packing into that city believing the Romans would never take it. The Hebrews were Hebrew Christians who were told to get out of that. So at the end of Hebrews 10 and verse 36, they were told what Habakkuk was told. You have need of patience. Wait for it, Habakkuk. It'll come. You have need of patience, that after that ye have done the will of God, ye might receive the promise. After ye have done the will of God. And the will of God, brethren and sisters, that all would be saved by faith, not by law. For yet a little while, quoting Habakkuk, and not it now, brethren and sisters, not it shall come as Habakkuk, but he that shall come. So the it of Habakkuk takes upon itself a personality. I'll put it back again for you. In Habakkuk, it shall come. But I told you, in your mind's eye, you've got to make that he that shall come. Now words. But the cross, brethren and sisters, is a personality. That's a principle. But he upon that tree, brethren and sisters, is the practice. That's a theory, true theory. But on that cross, brethren and sisters, is the reality. That's it. The other one's he. So when Paul quotes it in Hebrews 10, he's talking about a personality. When he comes. And he's coming again too. For yet a little while, and he that shall come will come and won't tarry. Now, says the apostle, the just shall live by faith. But if any man draw back, where will he draw back? Where would they go? To the city of Jerusalem. And they'd stand in that city and they'd say, you can't bring the Romans against us. That's not your character. God, you're too pure of them to do that. You could never use the Romans against us. Besides which, secondly, you couldn't do it because we're more righteous than them. And they drew back. But there were running men and running women who were running out reading that message. The just shall live by faith. But if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. That's Habakkuk. Now the apostle explains. He says, but we are not of them who draw back into destruction. And they're going back into that city. But he says, we are those that have faith. And that's what the word epistius means. We have the word believe. It means to have faith. We are those that have faith to the saving of the soul. And then in chapter 11, brethren and sisters, he goes on to describe the quality of faith. I don't intend to give an exposition of that, but this I intend to quote verse 13 to you. These all died in faith, he said, and he's talking about all those faithful people that he named who didn't believe in their human abilities. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and what? And embraced them. The word in the Greek isn't Habakkuk, brothers and sisters, but the meaning's the same. And there was a man that when he saw that, in chapter 3, reached out to God and embraced that faith. His problem was overcome. He had no more misconceptions. And then God revealed to him, what are you going to do with the Chaldean? He embraced it. Absolutely wonderful. And he did that, brethren and sisters, when there were many, many years to go before it would become he. We no longer have it, we have he. We don't have the theory that just shall live by faith, we've got the man. And the tallest letters ever written on that cross, that if he had to live by faith, where on earth are you and I ever going to give him the kingdom of God by law? That's the tallest letters ever written. And so God revealed to him in chapter 2 what he'd do with the Chaldean. You know, in chapter 2, brothers and sisters, there are five woes. We're not going to spend a long time on chapter 2. There are five woes in chapter 2. And this is what God's going to do with the Chaldean, and this is why. And so coming back to the message of Habakkuk, we read in verse 6, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. Halfway through the verse. Woe to him that increaseth that which is not his. And the Chaldean would come down with pride and ambition to add to the territory of his conquests. And in order to do that, brethren and sisters, the end of verse 6 says, he will lay himself with thick, thick clay. And clay, of course, if you've got clay feet, wherever they tread, they will pick up whatever they tread on. And the one's coming down with the feet of clay, brothers and sisters, and he's going to stand on the mountains of Israel, and he thinks that whatever his feet tread on, he's going to take up into his being, and they're his. Woe to him, says God. This is what's going to happen to the Chaldean. Verse 9. Woe to him that coveteth an evil covetousness. Security by extortion is the second woe. He will think an evil thought. And he will go back from Egypt. And I believe, after a period of time, not immediately, when he's bestrode the world, brothers and sisters, and feels himself secure. And after a period of time, he will think an evil thought. To that point, he's thought plenty of evil thoughts, but not like this one. And he'll turn back on the city of Jerusalem. And there he'll go back to extort from the world the security which he offers them. Woe to him that does that. Verse 12, woe to him that buildeth a town with blood. Power politics. That's what he's going to get knocked over for, brothers and sisters. Verse 15, woe unto him that giveth his neighbour drink. Woe to him that adversely affects others. And the Russian power, brothers and sisters, wants to stamp its brand upon every nation on the face of the earth by power politics. And verse 19, woe to him that saith to the wood, awake, and to the dumb stone, arise. Woe to the idolatry. And with the Russian will be his wonderful consort, the imperial majesty of the blasphemous harlot of Rome. Full of idolatry. Woe to that system, says God in his five woes. Five's the number of grace, brethren and sisters, and they don't deserve the grace of God. Because they are the things that people do when flesh takes over. Pride and ambition, extorting from people, power politics, adversely affecting others and serving self. Woe to those people who act like that. And the whole world acts like that, brethren and sisters. But don't worry about it. Look at verses 13 and 14. Behold, is it not of Yahweh of hosts that the people shall labour in the very fire and the people shall weary themselves for very vanity? Don't worry about it, brothers and sisters. The whole world's like that. When you go to work, as I do with my fellows, in the truth, which is a wonderful thing, you go to work and you're working with your fellows and you see that every day of your life. My message to them is don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Pass it off. Use a kind expression. Don't worry about it. Yahweh says they're labouring in the fire. They're in a fire. They're labouring to put it out and it won't go out. It's all around them. And one day, brothers and sisters, they're all going to frizzle. A whole lot of them. For it's all coming to a destined end. And people act like that. God's got full control of it. Don't worry about it. Let them have their pride and ambition. Let them extort from you. Let them use power politics. Don't worry if they think they're adversely affecting you. Leave them to their idolatries, brethren and sisters. They're labouring in the fire. And we're watching them burn. Because the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. And if you want to know, brethren and sisters, in this context, what constitutes the glory of Yahweh, it's the exact opposite to all that. There is no pride and ambition with people who follow Yahweh. They don't go around with the pressure of extortion to get their way. They don't go forth in power, politics, and ecclesial life to establish their brand. They don't adversely affect others, and they're not idolaters. They don't serve self or anything in this world. If that's the glory of flesh, then there are five graces, brethren and sisters, that are exactly the opposite that constitutes the glory of Yahweh. Don't worry about it, Habakkuk. I've got it all under control. That's chapter 2. And if he was worried about the Jews acting like they were, he'd wring his hands in anguish about the Babylonian. And God is saying, Habakkuk, don't worry about it. I've got Judah on the spotlight. The Chaldeans are coming down. They'll deal with him in no uncertain fashion. All you've got to believe, Habakkuk, is that just shall live by faith. When you've got yourself standing upon your watchtower correctly and your vision is correct, don't worry about what Judah's doing. Don't worry about what Russia's doing or the Chaldeans doing. Habakkuk, don't worry about it, because the glory of Yahweh shall fill the earth as the waters cover the sea. What a wonderful message. And all Habakkuk was told was, wait for it. He wasn't told to enter into peace pacts. He wasn't told to march in streets, brethren and sisters. He wasn't told to join committees. He wasn't told to go out and try and convert the world. He wasn't told anything like that. He says, wait. Wait for it, Habakkuk. And that's our privilege. We don't have to do that, brethren and sisters. It's not our job to convert this world. We convert a few here and there. We do our best. But we don't have to convert the world. Let them labour in that fire. Wait for it. Because it's coming. And you know, Habakkuk was so thrilled with that message. He saw the point. The letters were so tall that he let fly in chapter 3 with a prayer. It's really a psalm, brethren and sisters, upon Shigionoth. And that psalm is a wonderful psalm. A beautiful psalm, it really is. It's here somewhere. I'll put it back on again. First of all, we must be very quick with this, but oh boy, I'd like to spend... As I said, look, really, it's a shame. This chapter is one of the most glorious chapters in the Bible because it's so wonderful. But let's be quick about it. Let's make some very pertinent comments about it, brethren and sisters, and just see the flow of the context. The first two verses are a prayer for mercy upon Israel, upon Shigionoth, which means to cry aloud. Brethren and sisters, look, put it in its context. Put it in its context. In chapter 1, we had a voice crying aloud to God and saying, you can't see how wicked they are. You should be punishing this people. Now we've got a voice in chapter 3 that says, oh, in wrath, remember mercy. See the change. There's an acceptance of the wrath, but he knows it's got to come, but oh, God, be merciful. That's what he's saying, brethren and sisters. Revive thy work, or as the margin says, preserve alive thy work. In other words, I know Israel can't escape the Holocaust, God, but preserve them. And he will preserve them, brethren and sisters. In the midst of the years, he said, in the midst of the years, make known in wrath, remember mercy. Why does he say in the midst of the years? What's he talking about, brethren and sisters? You know what it is? That's an expression of faith. Here's faith. Here's real faith. In the middle of the years. It means exactly what the Authorized Version says. And what he's saying is this, that he looked back over the past history of Israel. He looked back over the times of the kings of Judah and Israel. And he saw, brothers and sisters, and years of misery and affliction. And it came to the point of Habakkuk's day. And he originally believed that no heathen power could ever take Judah. But now he sees years stretching up the other way. In the middle of the years, they had come, brethren and sisters, or they'd gone rather, they were past, and they were future. But he's saying to God, you'll go on doing what you said. The letters are too tall for me to miss. I know that's right. But in the middle of all those years, past and future, remember mercy. And God has, brothers and sisters, the Jew is still with us. And he's getting to the end of those years. And then Habakkuk comes to his great dissertation about the great conquests of Yahweh. You know, brothers and sisters, in this psalm, there are two Selahs. There is one in verse 3, and there is one in verse 13. And if you look at the two Selahs, he says, think about this. Here they are. I wish I put them on a transparency. First C though is the Holy One, Eloah, singular. The Holy One has come from the south. Think about that. That's your first Selah. And what's the next one you've got to think about? The next Selah, brothers and sisters, is that the serpent has been bruised on the head. Think about that. And there, you might say, are the two great sounding symbols of Habakkuk's psalm. Think about that. Crash! The Holy One comes from Mount Paran, from the south. So he rises up from the south. Think about it, brethren and sisters, he's coming. And the second great crash of the cymbal in Habakkuk's wonderful symphony of psalms, crash! The serpent is bruised on the head. Think about that. Oh, dear, they are wonderful musical notations in that psalm. And they're the two things to think about as he opens up that psalm. I'm not going to deal with it in verse by verse, but you'll notice in that psalm, careful Bible readers, brethren and sisters, will notice that he lifts from the Old Testament a lot of incidents, but there are three major incidents that he lifts from the Old Testament into that psalm to remember that God in the past went forth for the salvation of his people. He quotes in verses 3 and 4 the words of Moses in Deuteronomy 33, verses 1 to 2. He quotes in verse 11, the sun and the moon stood still, the 10th chapter of Joshua, when Yahweh worked a strange work in the day of Gibeon. Remember Isaiah 4:28? A very strange work was worked on the day of Gibeon. And he remembered that, brethren and sisters. And he remembers in verse 10 and in verse 13, the great song of victory that Deborah sang when they overcame the power of Sisera on the plain of Jezreel. And Habakkuk looks back over the span of years before him, and he saw that in the midst of those years, Yahweh preserved alive. And he brings to remembrance those wonderful victories of faith when Yahweh went forth for the salvation of his people. Now we know, or most of us know anyway, a lot of us don't, we'll cover this another subject again. But you see, there was Deuteronomy 33 concerning the one who would come. It's taken up in Psalm 68 and projected to the future. There'll be the judgment of Mount Sinai. There'll be the moving forth of the saints in the age to come, when a fiery law will go forth from their hands to judge the world. And Habakkuk picked that up, brothers and sisters. If you turn to the 33rd chapter of Deuteronomy and keep your hand in Habakkuk chapter 3, you will see he's quoting these verses. In Habakkuk, in Deuteronomy 33, for example, verse 2, and he said, Yahweh came from Sinai and rose up from Seir unto them. He shined forth from Mount Paran, and he came with 10,000 of his saints. From his right hand went a fiery law for them. Or as the margin says, from his right hand went a law of fire. And so here he sees, brothers and sisters, Yahweh rise up from Sinai and from Mount Seir, and there's 10,000 of his saints, his holy ones, and a fiery law goes forth from their hand. You come back to Habakkuk. Verse 3, Eloah, the mighty one, came from the south, the holy one from Mount Paran. Consider that. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise, and his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. Now the word horns, brethren and sisters, you'll read in the margin, bright beams out of his side. But really, what it's saying from the Hebrew, and Brother Thomas beautifully expressed it here, brethren and sisters, that they were coming out of his hand like pencil rays of light, a flare of fire from his hand. As one translation puts it, rays flashed from his hand, from his right hand. And who's at God's right hand, brethren and sisters, but his son? And who is his right arm, as Isaiah says, but the Son of God? And who will stand up at Sinai and judge us according to the eternal principles of the just shall live by faith, but God's Son? And who is it that will go with him but the 10,000 saints or holy ones who will come with the Eloah, the one singular holy one, and come from the south to bring down the world, brethren and sisters? And in the right hand, that is God's Son, there will be the hiding of his power, 10,000 times 10,000 rays of light. Every saint from all ages will be there, brethren and sisters. That's what Habakkuk saw. This was a graphic acknowledgement that Yahweh was in control. Verse 6 sees the Son of God standing and measuring the earth. He stood and measured the earth. What does he mean by that, brethren and sisters? What does it mean when he measures the earth? You know, when David took captives, he measured them. Some he put to death and some he left alive. And those he left alive, some he got doing this and some he got doing that. And the Son of God standing astride the world with the pencil rays of light flashing from his right hand, bringing the world to its knees, brethren and sisters, will measure the earth and he'll say, some to destruction, some to life, some to do this and some to do that. And he will divide the land. The 12 tribes will get that and it'll all be measured. Habakkuk saw that so graphically. Verse 7, he sees the envy of the Arab problem, brethren and sisters. The tents of Cushan and affliction, the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. They are not destroyed, but they are measured. And those words, Cushan and Midian, as Brother Thomas says in Eureka and other writings, they sum up that the Arab peoples of the Arabian Peninsula, who were in that day, speak for the Arab peoples, and they will feel the weight of Christ's judgment, first of all, as he comes up from the south. They will be measured. Verse 8 and 9, the rivers and the seas of nations, brethren and sisters, are absolutely threshed into foam by God. He's displeased with them. The end of verse 8, he goes forth with the chariots of salvation. And the word cherubim, the wonderful lid of the ark, with the figures of the cherubim, with the wings touching over the top, and the faces gazing into the glory of Yahweh, brethren and sisters, solid gold box. The lid of the box, solid gold the lid. Built out of it with the cherubim of one piece, with their wings over the top, are called in the First of Chronicles chapter 28 and verse 18, the chariot of the cherubim. And God will ride with his mercy, overshadowing the mercy seat. He will ride in that chariot, brethren and sisters, all faces looking into the solid gold of the Son of God, and he'll come with those glorious chariots of the cherubim to bring to an end the might of Russia and all that Russia stands for. And verse 12, Armageddon, the threshing in the valley of judgment. He will thresh the nations in his anger. And then in verse 13, thou wentest forth for the salvation of thy people, even for salvation with thy Christ, thine anointed, brethren and sisters, Hebrew Messiah. He's the Eloah. He's the mighty one. And what's he going to do? He will wound the head of the house of the wicked by discovering the foundation under the neck. Think about that. This is how Rotherham puts it, brethren and sisters. Thou hast come forth for the salvation of thy people, to salvation with the anointed one. Thou hast crushed the head of the lawless one. My brethren and sisters, bruising the serpent's head is a final blow. But it's not done once. It'll be done three times. Because you see, the serpent has different stages to its development. The Lord Jesus Christ finally crushed flesh in himself. No longer will it ever find its way in him. When he comes a second time, in Habakkuk chapter 3 here, he will bring to an end international politics. That's what that's talking about. Power politics will finish. It'll be a final blow upon the head of the serpent of power politics. But it won't be until the millennium, brethren and sisters, when the serpent power is entirely eradicated, that it will be said in its absolute sense that the serpent has been bruised upon the head. But it's true nonetheless here. This is the end of power politics in verse 13. Now the last part of that chapter, from verses 16 onwards, brethren and sisters, Habakkuk expresses his acceptance of the will of God. He's humbled, he quivers, he trembles, rottenness enters into his bones, he trembles in himself and he says, oh, why didn't I understand this earlier? Why didn't I realize the character of God, that God will justify any man who believes in him? He doesn't have to be one of my people. But nonetheless, he's promised that he will preserve my people despite their wickedness. Isn't he wonderful? And he trembled in himself to know the truth, brethren and sisters, as he'd never seen it before. And he was now going to wait. He was going to wait. And he says, in the middle of verse 16, that I might rest in the day of trouble, when he cometh up unto the people, he will invade them with his troops. The RSV puts it like this, I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon the people who invade us. And he watches the Chaldean come down. He sees all the desolation of Israel. He doesn't move. He just stands there on his watchtower. He watches it all and he waits. In his mind, he sees Israel crushed by the Chaldean. He sees his people in agony. He sees women and children killed. He sees blood spilt. He knows it's all right. He knows that God is perfectly justified in doing it, though they be Jews. He said, that's perfectly right. But he says, I'm going to go on waiting, waiting and waiting until God deals with that Chaldean. And because he knows the truth now about human nature, he knows the truth about Russia. And he'll wait for it. And he uses all expressions of Israel in verse 17. Yes, the fig tree won't blossom. There'll be no fruit in the vines. The olives shall fail. The fields will yield no meat. The flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stall. All symbols of Israel. The fig tree, the vine, the olive, the flock, and the herd. It'll all go. But I accept that he said. But he said, yet I will rejoice in Yahweh. I will joy in the God of my salvation. For all that, as it was in the days of Noah, brothers and sisters, yes, the ecclesia are going to go into decline. You know what they're going to do? They're going to marry. People are going to marry and marry and marry. And people are going to go on giving in marriage and giving in marriage and giving in marriage. In other words, young people and older people will marry and marry and marry again. And their parents will say, yes, 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 yes. It's going to happen. Jesus said it would. The ecclesia are going to turn to the churches. I'm going to read a letter to you on that meeting, brothers and sisters, where a notable brother has sounded a warning in the magazine of our brotherhood of England that they're turning to the churches. People are going to turn to the churches. Standards are going to drop. Attitudes are going to change. Flesh is going to have its way. It's all going to happen, brothers and sisters. The fig tree, the vine, the olive, the flock and the herd, all symbols of the ecclesia. It's all going to be it's all going to suffer. We're going to see sad things. But we'll wait. We will wait. Because the world that invades our brethren will in the end be destroyed. And we will wait, brothers and sisters, and amidst all that sadness, we will try to rejoice in Yahweh and joy in the God of our salvation. For what's he going to do for us? Yahweh Elohim is my strength, and he will make my feet like hinds' feet. He will make me to walk upon my high places. I've seen that, brothers and sisters, with my two eyes. I've seen that symbol. I've seen it. Down in the Negev, I saw two gazelles. We all seen it. They were on that trip. And we seen them go up the side of a mountain. It's unbelievable. We saw them climb a sheer mountain. You couldn't believe your eyes. The sure-footed hind. But you see, brothers and sisters, it's not just the symbol that's important here. With Habakkuk, being a musician, knowing that music must come to a crescendo, knowing there must be a finale which everyone will gasp for breath, knows exactly what to say, brothers and sisters. And what does he do? He lifts words from where? Oh boy, 2 Samuel 22 and verse 34, Psalm 18 and verse 33, because the two chapters are identical, brethren and sisters. The two chapters are identical. Psalm 18 is but a repetition of 2 Samuel 22. It's word for word for word. And why does he quote from that section? Because, brethren and sisters, at the head of Psalm 18 it is written, the Psalm of David, when God delivered him from the hand of all his enemies. And crash goes the cymbals. He will make my feet like hinds' feet. When David was delivered from all his enemies. And that's the end of the Psalm of Habakkuk, brethren and sisters. And we await that glorious day. And though the things will happen that the word of God says will happen, and sadness will come, we will joy in Yahweh, rejoice in the God of our salvation, brethren and sisters, because it will come when God will subdue all our enemies.